Buddy, to the February 25th, 2015 meeting of the Business and Transportation Committee. I apologize for starting this a little late. Let's see here. We'll do introductions later. We're going to start out with a work session on Senate Bill 32. Anyone to bring us up today, James?
Mr. Chair, fellow committee members, Senate Bill 32 directs Public Utility Commission to form work group to study methods by which natural gas public utility may expand service to areas that do not currently have access to natural gas. Requires commission to report to the interim committee of the Legislative Assembly related to energy by September 15, 2016. Sunsets on January 2, 2017, declares emergency effective on passage. There is no revenue impact, there's no fiscal impact, and there's no amendment.
No amendments. All righty. Senators, just to get us started here, I think we heard this the other day, and put it on the table, the chair would move Senate Bill 32 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Let me just say, as I look at this, I understand and appreciate the concerns that a lot of the folks in the propane community have raised, and I appreciate that, but I don't think it will have a direct impact on it. There are some issues that, as we talked about before, with trying to encourage distribution lines for natural gas to build that industry for cars in the area. There's certainly some economic development issues that are out there. All of that may prove to be non-workable as the PUC looks at, but I think it's appropriate for them to look at that. I've heard some people express some concerns about who would be on the work group, and I will tell you that from my experience when I was at the PUC, it's a pretty open process, and I would expect that that would continue if they move forward with this. It's not one that excludes people. It's at the expense, sometimes it's overly inclusive but and drags forever. But I think it's a process that we probably ought to do, and as we heard from the staff the other day, I don't think this would be a huge, expensive undertaking. It's the kind of thing that they do all the time and won't require, I don't believe, and I'll take them at their word, a lot of additional revenue. Right, Michael? And I got a head nod from the Senator.
Thank you. That was my concern, actually, is I don't, we say there's no fiscal, but I know there is a fiscal. It's just, as you maybe said, not a great amount, but there is a fiscal. And there will be, because people are going to be spending their time on it that they could be spending on other things. So that does concern me, that we're actually spending time on something that I believe that the gas company already does. They already know the obstacles and what needs to be done. So that does concern me.
Okay. I appreciate it. I will say, again, Senator Riley, from my experience during my decade over there, that this is the kind of thing they do. In fact, I'm not really sure that they need legislation to do it, but it doesn't hurt. Senator Thompson.
I'm probably going to be a no today, because my history is if you vote no in committee, you don't get put on the task force.
I don't think you would have that concern anyway, but okay. Other comments? Any other discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? Senator Thompson, who doesn't want to be on the task force. Anybody else? Okay. Senate Bill 32 is passed to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Thompson in opposition. I will carry the bill. So we'll close on 32, and let's see. Is Senator Johnson here?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 534. James?
Senate Bill 534 authorizes a city and an airport to enter in an agreement pursuant to which the city provides sewer and water to the airport without requiring the annexation or consent to eventual annexation to the city of the territory where the airport is located. Declares emergency effective on passage. There is no revenue impact, there is no fiscal impact, and there is no amendment.
Senator Johnson.
Permission to bring a visual aid.
Can I open a public hearing to a work session?
He said public hearing. Well, this is just a work session.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the courtesy of
taking this while I'm here. I just ran down two flights of stairs, which is tricky to do in my condition. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing Senate District 16. And I am here in support of this bill today. I think you heard previous testimony about the bill. I brought with me a visual of Aurora. This is where much of the controversial questions about this bill have come from. And I just want to point out to you the amount of economic activity going on at this airport. It is really astonishing. I managed the Aurora Airport for 5 years, and the South End didn't look anything like it looks right now. Excuse me. And I want to call attention to the amount of jobs, payroll, opportunity. I want to tell you about my home airport, which is Scappoose International. And at that airport, contrary to people's... Scappoose International. Contrary to most people's perception about airports, that these are just for taking off and landing airplanes, I want to tell you about a company that is producing pipe that does in-conduit hydro, made out of the same material that that airplanes are made out of. And this isn't when we're riveting airplanes together. This is when we're baking airplanes together. So this very high-tech material is being used to do in-conduit hydro for conservation purposes. Another company there is producing equipment that has been used in the theaters of battle and saved literally hundreds of lives. We have a company at Scappoose that is working on the two commercial spacecraft, and we have a company at Scappoose who provided engineering and work on the tail section of Boeing's Dreamliner. Today there are kids running around the building with little CTE and STEM buttons on. That's what we're talking about at the airports. This isn't just a place where the barnstormers are and some kid pumps fuel and somebody learns to fly. These are the economic generators of our state. That's one of the reasons that Chambers of Commerce, the Oregon Chambers of Commerce, have supported this bill, because they think providing essential services to these key economic drivers is part of what's going to help Oregon revitalize. And especially rural Oregon, where airports are essential both for transportation and for the growth of the kind of jobs that we're talking about. So I really am here to tell you that this bill, I think, is one of the more important economic development bills of the session, and I hope you would give it your thoughtful consideration and move it out of here and on its way through the rest of the process. Thank you.
Questions of the Senator. Senator Riley.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator, for that presentation. I wonder, are these economic developments, are they taking place on the airport property itself, or are they ancillary? Are they around the airport?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. Aurora is a perfect example, and I will stay out of the esoterica of a theory in aviation called through the fence. Mm-hmm. In some cases, it's on airport property. The Port of Portland, for example, in your district, does not have through the fence at Hillsborough, so it is right. All on Port of Portland property. It's leased buildings, leased capital improvements. Other airports, courtesy of this legislative body, have received the benefit of being what are called through the fence airports, where private capital is put at risk on private property, but it inures to the benefit of the entire airport complex, and those relationships are governed by contract and grant assurance restrictions from the FAA. So it's a mixed bag of both. It just depends what kind of airport. Scappoose International, through the fence. Heavy capital development on private property, as well as development on Port of St. Helens owned property, which helps that unit of government. So it's a mixed bag.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Senator Monroe.
Good evening.
Hi.
Almost.
Can't come soon enough today.
The genesis of this bill primarily comes from Aurora and the Aurora Airport. At least that's who we've heard the most about. If we pass this legislation and they were to implement it, wouldn't it take approval by both the city of Aurora and the airport before water and sewer could be made available?
Through the chair, Senator Monroe. Yes, my understanding of this bill, my reading of it, is that this is a permissive bill. And this is not just willy-nilly, let's go build some pipes, let's go do whatever we feel like. This is a reflection of the partnership. And it's interesting that the jurisdiction that has whined about this is also the same jurisdiction that has complained about other safety improvements at Aurora. There's an awful lot of mythology going on here. They're not even the jurisdiction that would provide the services. It's Aurora. And I think that that partnership, because in Scappoose that partnership exists, and I'm sorry I keep defaulting to Scappoose, I just know it so well, the partnership between the airport and the city is legendary. And so this is not a mandate. This is not this would be the memorialization of a partnership of a municipality to see economic opportunity and job creation at their airport.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, that was my understanding. That's why I really can't understand the furor in some of the opposition.
I can't either, so don't ask me to explain it. I don't get it.
Okay.
More, Senator? Anybody else?
Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, have you heard 306 yet, Mr. Chair?
We have not.
Okay, I'll hang out. Thank you.
Okay. Well, let's see. So I have it open for a public hearing. Does anybody else wish to comment on 534? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 534 to get it on the table. The chair moves Senate Bill 534 to the Senate with a do-pass recommendation. So, and let me comment just briefly on that. Very good comments from the senator on the economic development and the uses around there, although I would point out for the committee that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about merely a bill which authorizes cities to extend sewer and water services to an airport, which, in my opinion, having seen a lot of them around the country, makes sense because, as a rule, you don't want airports inside a city for obvious reasons. You know, when unfortunately they go flop, you don't want them to be around houses and that sort of thing. The issues of the economic development and all that are matters of land use planning, which we have laws for. Any of that change would have to be done. In this case, I believe Southside would be by Marion County, or in most cases the county, in their land use applications, all of which would be appealable and have to be acknowledged by the Land Conservation and Development Commission. So I think we have laws that deal with that aspect, and that goes on regardless of what we do with this bill. This is just simply getting the services out there so it works. So, Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really appreciate the senator's presentation. And since this, especially since this is a permissive bill and doesn't require anyone to do anything they don't want to do, I'm going to be in favor of this bill.
Okay. Other discussion on the bill? Senator Monroe?
Have we heard from Metro on this bill?
I don't think we have. Don't think we had it. Did we have anything? Did we have
don't,
any correspondence?
I don't remember.
I don't believe we've had anything.
Yeah,
this actually is outside of Metro. But the policy would apply. Would the policy apply? I don't know if it Trout. I don't know if it would apply anywhere in Metro's territory.
It is outside.
Yeah.
Okay.
Where the Aurora is, I don't know if there's another airport inside Metro that it would apply to.
Mr. Chair, without looking at a map, I can't answer that.
I couldn't think so. The only ones I could think about were Troutdale and Hillsboro. I don't think it applies there. Okay, probably not. Anything else?
Well, I just want to remind everybody this is a statewide bill. In my own district, I have 7 rural airports. Silverton could have taken advantage of this. We had testimony about that. In Eastern Oregon, I think it'll be very beneficial in a lot of different cities. So I know that Aurora seems to be the focus of it, but really the bill is statewide.
Okay. Others? Okay. Is there any objection to the bill, to the motion? There is none. Senate Bill 534, with no amendments, pass to the Senate floor, but they do pass recommendation. And Senators
Johnson
and Girard, would you like to co-carry this?
Yeah, we could co-carry it.
Okay, that's what we'll do. So we'll close on that. And we will open on Senate Bill 29. Well, wait a minute. Excuse me. Let's, because you're here for 306, right, Senator?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Okay, let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 306. James?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 306 defines key terms, authorizes Oregon Infrastructure Finance Authority to provide loans or grants for levee project. When considering project eligibility, IFA must find that levee project substantially contributes to improvement, expansion, or repair of state's or municipality's infrastructure system, and is essential for use of development of farms, industrial, or commercial land in Oregon. Authorizes Water Resource Department to inspect, evaluate, and assess condition of levee with permission of levee's owner. Maintains legal liabilities of levee's owners. Declares emergency effective upon passage. We do have an amendment. It adds corporations or companies for drainage or flood control to a list of organizations that may receive financial assistance in the form of loan or grants from a levee project. There is no revenue impact, and there is an indeterminate fiscal impact. It also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you again for your courtesy, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16, much of which resides behind some kind of water management device. In the interest of helping you understand why this room is not packed, there is a companion bill in the House, House Bill 2436, that has already moved out of committee, had the amendment added to it, moved out of committee, and is now resting in Ways and Means. We decided as an insurance policy that it would be a good idea to go ahead with this bill. Consequently, I didn't ask all the same people to come and testify, but let me just give you a sample. The mayor of Warrenton, that has struggled ferociously with dike and levee issues since the feds, mostly FEMA and Congress, changed some of the ways that they deal with diking districts after Katrina and Sandy was here. The Farm Bureau was here from Tillamook County. Steve Greenwood was here from the Portland metropolitan area. He is, on behalf of the governor's office, working in Oregon Solutions Project with dikes and levees that protect Portland International Airport. And so they were all here testifying, and I just didn't run them all back over here again. But this bill is, the policy merits of this bill are reflected in the governor's budget, where money was set aside to help various legal constructs of diking districts or diking management corporations deal with assaying the condition of their dikes and then having money available through Oregon Business Development Department for low-cost loans to help repair the dikes. And to give you an example of why this is so important, I represent Savis Island. Savis Island is, I'm told, the largest freshwater island in the world. It's surrounded by the Multnomah Channel and the Columbia River. Almost 20 lineal miles of dike, all of which needs to be inspected, some of which needs to be repaired at a cost of somewhere between $400,000 and $500,000 a lineal mile. And so this is a huge problem. The $7 million that the governor has in his budget scratches the surface of fixing these water management devices. But the peril of being behind an uncertified dike, other than the thing might fail and flood your place, is the fact that you can't sell a business, you can't sell a home. It used to be that the feds partnered with diking districts, and I'll give you another example from Scappoose. Our little diking drainage district used to set aside about $50,000 to do their dike inspection every year. Congress passed an amendment called the Wright Amendment, which made it impossible for the federal government to compete with private engineering firms. Consequently, they couldn't have this partnership between the Corps and the diking district. They'd have to go out and hire an engineering firm. Bottom line is it would cost $2 million. So the diking district came to the community and said, oops, you now live behind an uncertified dike. And so this is a giant problem. And I would respectfully ask that you consider the amendment. When we drafted the bill, we thought we had included all of the various architectures, and there still may be more legal constructs of bodies that are responsible for dikes and levees. And so the bill may get amended again as others hear about it and come forward and say, oh, you forgot how we're organized. But the purpose is to make all of those units that are responsible for the inspection, repair, and management of these dikes and levees eligible to be part of this project that will be administered through OBDD. So again, I would make the case to you that this is a pretty good economic development bill. To render anything behind an uncertified dike is basically not saleable matters a lot to people whose largest single asset is frequently their home. So I commend this bill for your consideration. I think it's a great bill, and it will go down to Ways and Means to await its fate as the budget mosaic is formed.
That makes it sound a whole lot better than that. Questions of the senator on this bill? Seems like none. Senator, I'm going to ask you, are you also interested in testifying on Senate Bill 269?
Help me, Mr. Chair.
Increases pilot registration fees?
I'm going to leave that to the Department of Aviation. I would just say in the main, I am, even though I am one of those pilots and subject to those fees in the interest of transparency. Okay. And once upon a time, a million years ago, I ran the agency. They need the money. I sound just like a regular agency head, right?
Okay, thank you, Senator. We'll let you get back to your work.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 306? Come on down.
Did I lie?
No, you good. Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
Do you care about what order we go in, or should we just start?
Not a bit.
Okay.
It's up to you.
All right. Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Gerard, members of the committee, my name is Catherine Williams. I'm the State Affairs Manager for the Port of Portland, 7200 Northeast Airport Way, Portland, Oregon, 97218. The Port of Portland is a multimodal port overseeing both seaport and airport operations. The levee system operated by Multnomah County Drainage District protects over 40% of the port's facilities, including the Portland International Airport, Troutdale Airport, and Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Park. The Portland International Airport serves 14 million passengers annually, handles more than a quarter million tons of air cargo, and provides service from 30 carriers with more than 500 passenger flights daily. A significant portion of the buildable land inventory within the Columbia Corridor sits behind the levee system, which directly translates to future jobs and economic growth. These are thousands of future lots, including large lots. Allowing the Oregon Infrastructure Finance Authority to fund flood protection system studies, plans, assessments, certifications, and reaccreditations is important. The Infrastructure Finance Authority funding of $1.4 million in 2014 in Portland for completing PEN 1 and PEN 2 system engineering assessment and repair alternatives was critical to quickly and efficiently completing the work and convening community stakeholders. The IFA funding for any PEN 1 and PEN 2 repairs and Multnomah County Drainage District and Sandy Drainage Improvement Company reaccreditation activities will be critical to convening the communities and funding future projects. The Port is pleased to support passage of Senate Bill 306. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Reed Wagner. I'm the executive director of the Multnomah County Drainage District. I also manage three other drainage districts along the Columbia River. I'm going to skip all the things that you said. And I want to just explain how important this funding was in our projects in Peninsula Drainage District 1 and Peninsula Drainage District 2 in moving forward the progress of the project. We were at a stall point in our community because of capacity, funding, and governance, and didn't really know how to proceed with our partners. And it was the leadership that was brought by Business Oregon in identifying funding through IFA loans and a lot of hustle that really catalyzed this project and allowed it to go forward. So I can tell you we're on a good track from a project standpoint in reaccrediting these levees in those two small districts. But for that funding, I wouldn't be able to come here and tell you that today. So I just think it's a very important piece of leadership in our project. When you look on the West Coast, we're the only state that doesn't have some type of statewide coordination when it comes to funding and best practices with these projects. So I think this is a great first step in getting us in the right direction.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Monroe?
When I was 6 years old, they had some dike failures around the Port of Portland. It's called the Vanport Flood. That was before Senator Johnson was born. But it did cause a lot of grief. If this bill passes, can you guarantee that won't ever happen again?
I can guarantee you flooding will continue to happen. It's just how much that we can protect and reduce the risk in the future.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Anything else? Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 306? That's all I have on the sign-up sheet. Seeing none, we will close the public hearing and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 306. I would note, colleagues, that as Senator Johnson has indicated, Senator Co-Chair Devlin has asked that the bill be brought down to Ways and Means so they could work it with the bill coming from the House as well. So having said that, I will move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 306. Any discussion on that motion? Is there any opposition to that?
What do the dash one amendments do?
Say it again.
Adds corporations or companies for drainage or flood control to a list of organizations that may receive financial assistance in the form of loan or grants for a levy project.
Okay. Is there any objection to the amendment? Dash ones are adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 306 as amended by the dash ones to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Okay, Senate Bill 306, as amended by the dash ones, is moved to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. We'll close on Senate Bill 306, and we'll go back up and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 297.
Mr. Chair, fellow committee members, Senate Bill 297 allows applicants seeking license to practice professional engineering, land surveying, or photogrammetric mapping in Oregon to obtain qualifications for licensure in any order and make single application. Permits waiver of math, science, and engineering examination for applicants that have been licensed in another jurisdiction for 25 years or more. Enables Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying to refuse registration to applicants that have violated statute, rule, or standards in another jurisdiction that would be grounds for refusal, suspension, or revocation in Oregon. Identifies persons are responsible charge of photogrammetric mapping work. Revises authority over fees consistent with proposed revisions. Declares emergency effective upon passage. We do have three amendments to this bill. Dash one amendments, lessens the years of experience from 25 to 8 for registered professional engineers in another state for a waiver from the fundamentals of engineering examination requirement. There is no fiscal and no revenue with that. We have a dash two amendment, which requires State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying to waive the fundamentals of engineering examination requirement for registered professional engineers with 25 years of experience. No fiscal impact or revenue impact with dash two. And the dash three clarifies that any applicant holding a registration in another jurisdiction may apply for a licensure in Oregon without taking the national examinations again. It reduces barriers to entry into the profession of photogrammetry by adding geomatics-based programs, broadens the work of photogrammetric mapping for responsible charge to include all work as opposed to just project specifications. No revenue, and there's no fiscal impact.
Okay. Well, let's see. Who wants to address the amendments? Now, do we have agreement last time we sent them out? Please. Y'all were going to go out and try and come to agreement on all this, I believe.
Chair, committee member, my name is Michael Hardy. I'm a licensed professional engineer in the state of Oregon. 20-plus years experience. I had the privilege about 5 years ago of serving as the National Society of Professional Engineers national president, and through that became very well versed in licensure all over the world, globally as well as. I am opposed to amendments 1 and 2, dash 1 and 2, because the description specifically lists requirements for other licensures, people licensed in other states, and the ruling, the actual verbiage of that section says states or foreign country. And becoming aware of the licensure in all these other foreign countries, most foreign countries don't have engineering licensure laws. To waive the fundamental requirements for engineering licensure after 8 years of experience in a foreign country is not the same as the education we have in Oregon. The requirements anywhere, I have no problem with those amendments if it's in the a U.S. jurisdiction, but it specifically says, or a foreign country, and I have a big problem with that. I had the opportunity to travel to several foreign countries and see the status of their licensure. They are not the same as the U.S. Some countries are very well on par with the U.S., Canada, the U.K., for example, but not the majority of the foreign countries. And that is the 8-year restriction is a problem, or the reduction to 8 years is a problem, and then also mandating that the board shall waive that licensure takes away the discretion for them to evaluate these programs. I think both of those are very risky for the state of Oregon and the licensure in general. The Dash 3 amendments I'm in favor of because it is specifically providing more clarification in the area of photogrammetric. I can't say it either. Photogrammetric services. Questions? Thank you.
Questions?
I guess. Yeah. So let's get to the 8 years versus 25 years. So are you in favor if somebody spent 25 years? Because that was what was in the bill, right?
A long time.
The reality is that most foreign jurisdictions have not had a licensure statute for 25 years. And so there is no license in those countries that are 25 years old. There's a few countries, yes, but the majority, no. If it's going to take 25 years for somebody to become licensed through experience, then it's just as easy to come to Oregon, take our tests, or well, the national tests, and become licensed that way. There are already thousands of engineers from other countries licensed in Oregon by taking the existing process. And there's so the 25-year, yes, I'm concerned, but it's not something I would kill the other changes over.
How about the rest? I'm sorry.
Oh, the 25-year thing, I mean, how many people in their late 50s and 60s are going to...
My understanding of the primary purpose of the 25 years is that in applying for licensure within U.S. jurisdictions, you can't really go back 25 years and verify that the test they took is the same as the test we took. It's more of a administrative problem that the Ausbils board is trying to fix. An engineer with 25 years of experience and then the other provisions in the bill for performance and no complaints, et cetera, I think that takes care of...
That was the intent.
Yes, that's the intent. It's tacking on that or foreign jurisdiction that makes it a little more dicey for me.
I guess the problem, I think the sponsor of the bill, I think it was Senator Roblin, mm-hmm. was trying to work with, we're part of a North American thing
yes.
that includes Canada, trying to get Canada in,
yes.
but the amendment really doesn't do that.
I don't think it does. Like I say, I personally have no qualms with some of the Canadian engineers and other foreign countries like that, but it's just the way it's written, it really, it's just too wild.
Okay.
That's what I guess.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So do you support the bill with the Dash 3s?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Okay.
Marshall?
Good afternoon, Chair Byers and members of the committee. My name is Marshall Koba, representing the American Council of Engineering Companies. We'd like to thank Ausbils for the work session that we had a couple hours out at their office following the meeting the first day, the initial hearing, and the first day of the session. We, too, oppose the Dash 1 amendments. We oppose the Dash 2 amendments, but we do support the Dash 3. And since I did talk to you earlier, Senator Byer, there has been an email from our friends in Canada that are involved with Penoir, which is what Senator Roblin was involved with, indicating they are not interested in holding up the bill and will go to their summer meeting, have continued conversations with this, and bring it back next session or in the future. So the concern that I expressed to you at that point seems to be moot at this point.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else need to comment on this one?
Did I open a work session or a public hearing?
Opened a work session, didn't I? All righty. So to get it on the table, the chair moves the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 297. Discussion on that motion.
Seeing none, is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, the dash-3s are adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 297 as amended by the dash-3s to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? There is none. Let's see here. Will Senate Bill 293 as amended by the dash-3s is moved to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Carrier.
Like you said, 293, and you meant 297.
Excuse me, 297. Correct. Thank you.
Okay.
Senator Thompson is volunteering to carry a bill.
Sure.
Senator Thompson will carry. Thank you. Close on 297. And we're down to, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 269. James.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 269 increases pilot registration fees from $12 to $24 for initial registration and from $24 to $48 for renewal registration, raises aircraft registration fees for all classification, increases airport registration and renewal fees for all classifications. There is a revenue impact light statement and a fiscal light statement, and it also has a subsequent referral to finance and revenue. There is no amendments.
Okay. Mr. McCormick. That's all I have to test since. You can come up if you want. Welcome.
Excellent. For the record, my name is Sean McCormick. I'm a policy advisor at the Oregon Military Department. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 269. The pilot registration fees covered by this legislation help finance the search and rescue program inside the Office of Emergency Management. That program is made up of one position that supports search and rescue actions across the state. A little bit of perspective, in 2014, there were 858 reported SAR actions across the state, and 113 of those called in to OEM or the Joint Operations Center for some level of assistance, whether that was fuel reimbursements, air support from the Army National Guard, support in finding a missing aircraft, or support in finding an electronic beacon. The SAR coordinator at OEM reviewed and approved fuel reimbursements for four counties, Benton, Douglas, Grant, and Jackson, and those reimbursements totaled $5,340. And those fuel reimbursements are also paid for with the pilot registration fees. The SAR coordinator also, on an annual basis, develops a search and rescue report. It's quite extensive, about that big, 130 pages, and it consolidates statewide data on all things search and rescue. And that report is shared with all of our county partners. And then finally, the SAR coordinator works collaboratively with all of our county sheriffs because ORS 404 puts the responsibility for search and rescue with our county sheriffs. For the 15-17 biennium, the military department is set to receive just under $52,000 in pilot registration fee revenue from the Department of Aviation for the SAR program. But the total cost of that program is about $215,000 on a biennial basis. So pilot registration fees cover about 24%, and the remaining 76% is covered with 911 emergency communications excise tax revenue. In coordination and collaboration with our partners over at ODA, if Senate Bill 269 is passed, we're expecting an increase in revenue coming to OEM for search and rescue actions of about $20,000, additional revenue in the 15-17 biennium, and $30,000 to $40,000 in the 17-19 biennium. So that'll increase the percentage from 24% to 38% by the 17-19 biennium that is covered by pilot registration fees. And the big deal here is it will help reduce the impact to our 911 funds that we're trying to set aside for work on transitioning our PSAPs off of an analog network and onto a digital network, and then transitioning the state to a next-generation 911 environment. So, in conclusion, the military department is here to support Senate Bill 269, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mitch Swecker. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Aviation, and I'm here before you today to ask for fee increases for pilot registration, aircraft registration, and airport licensing. So I wanted to start with just showing you that what we do is in statute. So ORS 836.105 regulates how we license the 97 public use airports. And then ORS 837 is for pilots and aircraft registration. I'd also like to point out that we don't get any general fund or lottery funds. We're an entirely other funded agency. So everything we do is from either fuel tax or the revenue that we collect from aircraft and pilot registration, leases, access fees, fuel flowage, and some inspections. So these are the proposals that we have here, pilot registration, Senate Bill 269. It's also part of our budget policy option package number 100. And this is the requirement for pilot registration, that every pilot operating within the state should register with the state, with the exception of scheduled airline pilots. And so we don't ask for them. And even non-resident pilots that are operating commercially inside the state would be required to register as well. And then the disposition of the money, OEM just talked to you about, Sean just talked to you about searching for lost planes, lost persons. That's for the reimbursement of fuel. It also supports their SAR position, and it should provide insurance, or may provide insurance, for injuries or loss of life for SAR volunteers and education and training. That's a may. So right now the fees don't cover all of the things that it's obligated to cover, either for OEM or for us. So we have a FTE position that initially we had at 0.5 FTE funded. We've reduced that to 0.3 so we can continue to provide a stable amount of dollars to OEM of about $51,000 and some change. So we take the remainder of that out of our operations department, which takes away from what we do for some of the airports in the state. And then OEM, he mentioned, pays for about 0.24 of a SAR position. And then we paid, he says, about $5,000. We have on our records about $7,000 for fuel reimbursement so far in the biennium. And then one of the things that we ultimately need to do at some point in the future is to modernize our software. We're using an Access database right now. And then there's reasons for this, and that is that there's a lot less general aviation flying going on right now. The pilot population is aging out. The cost of fuel, the cost of time to train, and the time to train is increasing. Price of aircraft is expensive. And so what we've gotten data is that pilot registrations are down by about 6% per biennium for the past three bienniums. And I wanted to illustrate this chart right here. If you look on the left side, it's jet fuel gallons. And it's in the hundreds of thousands, and that corresponds to this red line. And then the blue line is avgas gallons, what the typical general aviation pilot would fly with. And you can see that going from 2006 forward, we had the recession in 2009 or so, and the fuel sales in the state continue to decline. So there's just a fewer pilots flying, so there's fewer people registering to fly and fewer aircraft registering. And this is the business model for how we provided the revenue to OEM. The top blue line there is our revenue, and transfers, not expenditures, are how we give money to them. So it comes out of our revenue line. Our expenditure line is entirely for administrative costs, that 0.3 FTE that I mentioned earlier. And you can see we've already given them some revenue here and again right here. And then we'll project it to give them another bit here. And we give them as much as we can possibly give them, close to the thing. Now, we have a beginning balance of about $15,000. We hope to have that beginning balance at the end of the biennium as well, so that we start the next year with a little bit of a cushion. But we give them absolutely as much as we can possibly give them. And then this is what the 15-17 biennium looks like. Forecast revenue, about $93,000. Personal services, this is more. We actually have more than the 0.3 that we do personal services from. We have three people that have a hand in that. So when our 0.3 FTE guy goes to lunch or goes on vacation, somebody else can pick up the slack. We don't have a single point of failure for pilot registration. And then the services and supplies, that's mostly postage and sending out 30, 60, and 90-day letters. And then the fuel reimbursements I talked about earlier, $7,000 plus. And then here's the money that we transfer to OEMs. Total obligation, roughly about $120,000. That leaves us a little bit short, about $27,000. If we do this fee increase, we'll get about $62,000 extra, of which we'd give probably half. He said $20,000. I'd say closer to $30,000 in the first biennium, and then subsequent biennium probably closer to $40,000. Because this won't take effect until January, which is two quarters into the next biennium. If there are no questions on pilot registration, I'll go into the aircraft registration piece. And again, anybody who flies an aircraft in the state, capable flight base in the state, with exception of the commercial airlines, required to register in the state. This is a fee structure that we're looking at. What we primarily tried to do was to keep the low end, because we talked about general aviation is declining, to keep the low end kind of low. So a single engine piston, we're only looking at about a $10 increase. But at the high end, at the jet level, we would probably double, we would like to double the fee from $350 to $700. Why is that? Because it's still relatively inexpensive relative to other states. For example, California, the annual cost is 1% of the value of the aircraft. So you got a $40 million aircraft, you're paying a heck of a lot of money, and there are actually companies that come to Oregon and register aircraft in Oregon rather than register them in California. Why do we need the increase? In 2012, the FAA doubled the amount of match that's required for their grants. They were at 95% of project cost. Now they're at 90%. So for a $2 million project that used to be $100,000 out of the sponsor's pocket, now it's $200,000. This is the primary, aircraft registration fees are the primary source of our grant match. So we pay the 10% grant match for the 12 federally funded airports that our agency operates in order to pay our 10% grant match. Cost of construction is increasing. There's additional assessments that are increasing the cost of our contracts. There's a lot of endangered species that, and one in particular, street cornlark, that likes to hang out at airports because the grass is short. And we have to do a lot of mitigation around that when we do construction projects, and it involves a consultant to have to do that. And then this isn't going to solve our non-federally funded airports, but we do have tasks that we would like to be able to use at least a small percentage of the revenue for, and I'll show you one in particular. This is Crescent Lake, which is deteriorating. That asphalt's failed. If we got sufficient additional revenue, it's not out of the question we could repair this. This airport is closed right now. And what we would probably try to do would be to take a small amount of money, $100,000 or so, and be able to grind that pavement up into a gravel runway. Then it's open to the general public again. Okay, I mentioned other states charge more for aircraft registration. California, 1% of the value. Montana, up to $3,000 for aircraft registration. Idaho, up to $600. And then Washington, only $140, but they have 11 cent excise tax on fuel, and then a sales tax of 6.5% on aircraft and fuel. And then one of the things we have to do as an agency is we're going to have to start registering public use drones per House Bill 2710 that passed in the last session. So we've got to have the database and ability to do that. This is a deferred maintenance slide. It's the bottom line here is that we have about $15 million in deferred maintenance that we're not going to be able to pay for with this revenue, but it just gives you an idea that there is a lot of undone maintenance out there in the airport system. This is the model of how we do aircraft registration. Again, the top line here is our revenue slide. And if you look at this particular biennium, we did one major project, which you see we paid for here. That's a transfer, not an expenditure. So we did the phase one, the design and engineering, here early in the first half of the biennium. We did the actual construction. This was at Cottage Grove. And that's a $2 million project, so our $200,000 came here. And then as we go forward in the rest of the year, you can see we'll be slightly negative for the year. We're able to do that because we have a beginning balance that's probably close to $450,000. We'd like to see that balance here, but that's the only way we can afford to go and spend more in a year than we make in that year, is the beginning balance that we had. These are the projects we have for this next fiscal year. We have what are called GEA entitlement projects. These are those that don't amount to a capital improvement greater than $1 million. And we have a policy option package for that. It includes things like master plans at Lebanon, obstruction removal at Molino, Chiloquin, fencing, Independence master plan, acquisition of land, and that gives you kind of a general idea of the types of projects that we do there. And then in addition to that, we have two capital projects, one at Condon, which we haven't done a heck of a lot of work at recently, and the other at McDermott. These are economic development projects. Each one of those will be about $2 million. If we didn't get the fee increase, we probably would have to postpone one of those. And then if I look at registration funding, this is our forecast revenue, about a little less than $600,000. Personal services, again, more than what we have. We have a 0.5 FTE for that. And then services and supplies is about 9K. Our G entitlement grant match transfers, that's the projects that aren't capital projects, scheduled or forecast right now to be about 327. And then the capital construction for those two projects at Condon and McDermott is about 427 for a total of about 800K. We actually have a shortfall of 261. The only thing that enables us to do that is the fact that we had a front, a beginning balance that's at about 450,000. But you can see if we go any bienniums where we're operating in the negative, we're not going to be able to sustain that very far. That's why the fee increase is required. Otherwise, we reduce the number of projects, we reduce the scope of projects, and we don't get the work done around the state that we'd like to do, and then there's economic development that's lost because of that. This is the revenue increases. In 2015, about 151K, and in 2017, about 202K, and that brings our totals to 707 in 15-17 and about 758 in 17-19. If there are no questions on aircraft registration fee increase, I'll go into the airport. Actually, should be license fees. It's been at $30, no matter what the category of airport, since the 1990s. And what we'd like to do is to base it on the category of airports, so commercial air service airports. This is really a small increase. We're not asking for a lot. And the more remote access airports, we probably wouldn't change at all. General aviation airports, the Myrtle Creeks, we would raise just by just a very small amount. And the $30 right now doesn't cover the cost of administration. Fee increases will help with some of the other services that we would provide. And it won't help much with the deferred maintenance. I just put that in there because it shows you that the overall scope of these increases, quite frankly, will not help with that, but it will help with some of the administrative costs for the agency. This raises about $5,000 per biennium. And subject to any questions, that concludes my presentation.
Why aren't you asking for more?
Chair Beyer, I don't think we could ask for more. We're doubling the pilot registration fee. We're increasing the aircraft registration fees by a fairly substantial amount at the high end. We recognize the GA community just isn't flying very much. But this is the extent of the resources we have available to ask for increases.
My sense is the people who are flying these planes and that, if they can afford those, they probably could afford to pay a little bit more. You're not asking for enough, but we're not going to deal with that. Senator Girard.
Yeah, the question, since you brought it up, is the Pilots Association, have they weighed in on this at all?
They have. You actually have a letter from them, and they have a kind of a lukewarm endorsement. They're never in favor of having their own fees increased. And you also have a letter from the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, which is a national organization, and I've spoke to their representative yesterday. They sent a letter as well. While they don't support it, they didn't oppose it in the letter that they sent to you, and they suggest that we should be asking for more from other resources.
Of course. It's the infamous man behind the tree. Other questions? Seeing none, thank you both. That's all I have written down to testify. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 269. And to get us going here, the chair moves that Senate Bill 269 be referred to Senate Finance and Revenue with a due pass recommendation. I don't believe we have any amendments, do we? No?
Nope.
Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Senator Thompson, don't want to pay your pilot's fees?
Don't want to be on the task force.
There's no task force. All righty. So Senate Bill 269 is referred to Senate
Finance and Revenue with a do-pass recommendation. Senator Thompson in opposition. We'll close on that. We're going to open a hearing on Senate Bill 329.
I'm not going to hear 286.
Yeah, I had a request to this one first.
Okay.
You're up, James.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 329 increases annual fee imposed on public utilities and telecommunications providers from a maximum of 0.25% of the utility's gross operating revenue to a maximum of 0.30% for the purposes of defraying costs of public utility commission. Declares emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact, and we have a fiscal light statement.
Fiscal light. Okay, so where are we at here? This is 329. All right. Michael. Welcome.
Thank you.
Want some money, huh?
Oh, yeah. Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Gerard, members of the committee, my name is Michael Daugherty. I'm staff at the Public Utility Commission. Senate Bill 329 does modify RS 756.310 by changing the annual utility fee from a maximum of 0.25% of a utility's gross operating revenue to a maximum of 0.3%. This increase is requested to be able to continue the operations of the utility program and the Policy Administration Division of the Public Utility Commission. The fee change will increase the average cost per residential customer per bill per month from 17 cents to 20 cents. This fee is collected by the utilities and remitted to the PUC. With the exception of 2010, the annual utility fee has been set at 2.5 mil since 1997. Investor-owned utilities serve over 3 million customers in Oregon and grossed approximately $4.95 billion in revenue in 2013. The increase in fee is driven for two reasons that affect revenue. The first is that telephone landlines have decreased, which result in a corresponding decrease in revenue. Telephone landlines have decreased from a 1.26 million in 2009 to approximately 1 million in 2014. And also effective energy efficiency and conservation measures that have slowed the growth of energy utility that is assessed by the PUC. In my written testimony, I included a table that looks at 3 years of revenue, budget, and actual expenditures. As the table indicates, the budget was actually 20% greater than revenue. However, actual expenditures were only 87% of budget. Fiscal management actions taken by the PUC during this time include reduction in supervisor personnel, reduction in administrative personnel, vacancy and other savings, transfer of telecommunications division personnel to energy division, and deferral of information technology purchases. For 2015-2017, budgeted expenditures for the utility program and P&A are $4.7 million greater than forecasted revenue. Major program expenses are personnel, other personnel expenses, AG fees, and rent. I think it's important to note that we currently cannot reduce program personnel because of increased statutory requirements from both the federal and state, and also increased and complex filings by the energy utilities. Currently, PUC is using the balance of funds to account for the difference between revenue and expenditures. We estimate that if the change does not occur, we will exhaust our balance by 2019-2021. In addition, relocation expenses due to the capital renovation project will decrease funding by an additional $750,000 to $1 million. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I can answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Gerard.
Yeah, the question I have is, I mean, basically you're asking for a 20% increase. If we give you that increase, I mean, are you going to be able to live within your means for a substantial amount of time?
The fiscal impact statement that we submitted shows that we're okay for 2015-2017 and then 2017-2019, but as the years come on, we show if we use our complete budget that we'll actually have we won't have enough money. However, we also know that we only spend about 85 to 90% of our budget because we do things smartly. And so we try to stay within our means. And also, it's never the intent to increase our balance of funds beyond a 5-6 month time period. What we would do, since this is a maximum amount, if we find ourselves in a position because of good fiscal management, because of revenues increasing, then we wouldn't increase the fee or wouldn't ask for a 0.30%, we would ask for a smaller percent.
So I think the answer was you're good for at least three biennia?
Yes.
Other questions, Michael? Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Okay, Jeff, you want to come up next? And I don't know if Brant and Vonner, you want to come up too? You both. That's who I have on the list. Mr. Bissonnet, we'll let you go first so you can take off. And
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kids. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Bissonnet with the Citizens Utility Board. We represent residential ratepayers of utilities that the PUC regulates, and we are speaking in support of the bill. PUC and the staff do great work. They do live within their means, and you know, I have to say that there has been, we look at it particularly from the aspect of staffing, and people make that ship go. And if they don't, stuff doesn't get done. And I think you'll probably hear that from at least one of the utility representatives here. We have a very small staff, and so we do our best to keep up. But when the PUC with a much bigger staff runs slower than we do, you know, there's a problem. And so we are very much in support of the bill. We think that it's a very small price to pay for very large results, and we urge your adoption of the bill.
Mr. Wolf.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brant Wolf. I represent the Oregon Telecommunications Association, and we represent landline telecommunications providers throughout the state. So I struggled with this bill a bit, and I want to preface my remarks by stating clearly that if we take a dim view of this fee increase, that doesn't mean we take a dim view of the telecommunications staff that we work with. They're professionals, they're dedicated to their jobs, we work well with them, we have good relationships with them, and they manage at least one program that is vital to what we do in the rural parts of the state, so we appreciate that. However, there are some things we would like to get on the record and we would like for you to consider as you make your decision on how you deal with this bill. As Michael from the PUC indicated earlier, I looked at the PUC statistics books 2003 through 2013, 2013 being the latest one available. For the small, independently family-owned utilities, the telecommunications cooperatives, and our largest member, which is Frontier, from 2003 to 2013, the landline loss is $558,000 to $232,000, which is a $326,000 access line loss. Those are lines business into businesses, into homes. I don't know if this is an exact correlation, but as our business has dropped off, our regulated business, certainly our employee count has dropped off as well. Our largest small company member at one point in time over the last few years had over 80 employees full-time, and they now have fewer than 50. It's almost a 50% reduction in their employees. And again, I don't know if it's a person-for-person FTE drop-off or not, but I don't think it's unreasonable to consider that and think about that. The second point I'd like to make is that as our regulated business drops off and unregulated competitors to us, such as Comcast and Wireless, et cetera, and even our own broadband business, which is unregulated, when complaints or issues come in from that kind of thing, PUC staff goes to some – they do make some effort to help with those complaints, which is, you know, a laudable thing. But nevertheless, those unregulated competitors and unregulated services don't support the PUC staff that do that work. And we think, you know, that should be considered. In addition to that, there's at least one bill this session, Senate Bill 611, with some -1 amendments that, if adopted with those amendments, would indicate it would mandate the PUC staff begin managing an entirely new part of his business, a new program, potentially with entities that are not regulated and don't support the PUC. And I don't like to say things are unfair, but we just think that's plain wrong, particularly when you take into account the kind of company that we're talking about, which, as I understand it, is a huge, multinational, multi-billion-dollar company. We just think you should consider that. Finally, no fee increase should be considered in a vacuum, we don't believe. I know you all are aware of this, but there are several bills out that if passed this session, and you know maybe their odds are vary, but that would increase the 911 fee, would allow a county to charge a right-of-way fee for our facilities along county roads, new permit fees for crossing state lands, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. As Michael pointed out, this fee increase is just, it's pennies on our customers' bills, but it's pennies that count, and we just would like for you to consider that. As I mentioned, I struggle with this. We're not neutral on this bill. We don't support this bill, and you know, I guess I'll end it there. I'll answer any questions you care to ask.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, here representing Portland General Electric. PGE makes these comments first as an electric utility here in the state of Oregon, regulated by the Public Utilities Commission. PUC is funded by electric ratepayers, telecommunication ratepayers, doesn't receive general fund revenues. For us, the PUC performs two very important functions. The first is they go through the rate setting process for what we're able to charge customers, which is a complex and a lengthy process that involves fairly sophisticated stakeholders such as Citizens Utility Board and the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. We also, through long-term planning processes, do our integrated resource planning, which determines what resources we bring online over a period of time. Internally within the utility, we feel like we've got pretty talented staff, the rate staff, talented, well-educated people in terms of our planning processes. And when we look to the folks who are interveners in our dockets, we believe that we've got pretty smart, talented, committed folks working in the interveners. It's important to us that the people who are working at the Public Utilities Commission, the people who are the regulators, are able to match the talent and the skill levels of the people who are intervening in these dockets, and that the PUC staff are being able to kind of punch at the same weight, for lack of a better term, as the people who are working through the dockets. To find and keep talented staff at the Public Utilities Commission, it's increasingly, from our perspective, hard for the Commission to keep folks. They're competing with very well-paid private interests with the private sector, and we've had a challenge in recent years keeping qualified staff working at the Public Utilities Commission. We support this fee bill. We think that it helps to make sure that our regulator has the skilled staff they need to do an effective job. If the PUC came back and said that they needed to raise the fee again to make sure that they were able to attract and retain top staff to the Utilities Commission, we would consider and be in support of that. So with that, we encourage you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Questions of the panel? Thank you very much. That's all that I have signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify? Michael. Welcome. First time in front of us this time.
It's a pleasure, Mr. Chair. Mike Dewey, for the record, representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. So these are the cable companies operating in Oregon: Comcast, Charter, Wave Broadband, Ben Broadband, and the like, and others. So we are neutral on this bill. In the sense that at the end of the day, it's not a big hit. There are a couple things I do want to say, though. And I had another meeting, so I didn't get to hear Mr. Wolf's testimony, but he probably talked about the landline business. And cable companies provide telephone service. You may be a customer of a telephone, of a cable company. And it's voice over internet protocol, usually. And this is not a zero-sum game in the sense that we may be taking a customer from a regulated telephone company, or they may be taking a customer from us. The wireless industry is taking most of the customers, and we all know that, and that trend will continue. and this is based on landlines. So at some point, we're going to have a discussion about if it's not going to be general funds. And I get that it's hard to put general fund into this particular entity. Then we have to look at it perhaps a little bit differently and broaden the base. So that's something to we may have to look at down the road. We do think the staff is very good on the telecom side. But it's a little bit different than on the utility side because we're not really regulated except for a few areas. And we have tremendous competition in the telecom communication business, as you know. There are a number of carriers that you can speak to. Mr. Wolf and Senator Riley will know this. There was a discussion about Senate Bill 611, which would deal with hopefully effects on the central assessment issue, which is a big, big issue for companies in Oregon and economic development. And recently, and we're all waiting for the next LC draft to figure out what's going to be in it because the bill may come out tomorrow morning or tomorrow afternoon. But there is a provision in there to entice companies to build state-of-the-art broadband systems in a service area, and recognizing that we are very unique in terms of how we assess on property taxes, cable companies and other communication companies on intangibles. This is an incentive to take out the intangibles if you build out a system at least to 1 gigabit in a service area and you provide, and we again, we haven't seen the language, that service to at least 50% of the customers in the area, and it's at a reasonable price and the like. And the PUC would administer this program. And my issue was, okay, where's the money to do that if they had to hire people? I would suggest, at least initially, there would be very few companies that would be coming forward. And it's my understanding, we haven't seen the LC, is that there would be an application fee that would take care of the cost, like a permit fee that we would have at DEQ for our clients, for example. That would take care of that. And clearly, it would be in the interest of the company who wanted to get certified to have a way of paying less taxes to but provide state-of-the-art services. It would be in their best interest, I would argue, and there would be very few. So I've said a lot here. I'm happy to answer any questions. It's just that there are so many issues in this building, but Mr. Wolf is right. I do this on health insurance and the health care committee, that you can raise a rate here or put in a program here, here, and here, and it's 0.5%, 0.4%, whatever. After a while, it does increase insurance rates. So we get very concerned about that because we are in a competitive industry, and the rules and regulations, in some cases, there is not parity, and you've heard that from time to time. So with that, I will shut up, and if you have any questions, be happy to answer those questions.
Guys, we're all being very nice dancing around this. Any questions? Thanks, Mike.
Thank you for your time.
All right. Anybody else? You guys are being awfully quiet. All right. No one else? Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill
329,
and I think we'll let that one set for a while, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 286.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 286 increases maximum civil penalties from $10,000 per event per day with a maximum of $500,000 to $200,000 per event per day with a maximum of $2 million for violating statutes that provide for the regulation of hazardous substances by the Public Utility Commission, clarifies process for imposition of civil penalty and where monies collected are deposited, declares emergency effective on passage, no fiscal impact and no revenue impact. No amendments.
All right, Lori and Kevin. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Lori Coho, and I'm the administrator of the Safety, Reliability, and Security Division at the Public Utility Commission. And with me is Kevin Hennessy, who is the chair of Pipeline Safety at the commission. As was stated, this bill does modify the commission's civil penalty authority. And in November of 2013, we sent out notification to the operators asking if they had any objection to this, letting them know that we plan to introduce this legislation. And to date, we've not received any feedback or concerns on this proposal. If you don't know, the way it works is the feds are the ones who ultimately are responsible for all kinds of hazardous material transportation safety in the country, and they can certify states to run specific programs. We have certification to run the program for intrastate, within state, natural gas pipelines and certain LNG facilities that are associated with our intrastate pipeline operators. And with that certification, there are certain conditions that we are expected to meet, and specifically one of those, and the words they use, is that we must provide for the enforcement sanctions substantially the same as those authorized by the pipeline safety statutes. And so what we're asking for is to have that civil penalty authority align with what is in the federal statute. The reason that we're asking for that is because it does affect our certification. When the feds come in and audit us, which they do on an annual basis, there's a scoring sheet, and one of the very specific questions they ask is if we have adopted the same maximum civil penalties as they have in the federal statutes. And we continue to say no, and for a while we said, well, it's not really required, and then it was, we're going to put the legislation in there, and then now it's, you haven't done it yet, we're taking points off of your certification. We don't anticipate that to be a huge net fiscal impact. It kind of depends on their budget. Again, it's the appearance that it has for the state and for the agency if we're not adopting those penalties, maximum civil penalties, in alignment with federal standards. It is not our intent, and there is no requirement that we increase our fining or our penalties, and that is not our preference. We view penalties as a last resort. Our first and foremost goal is to have safety, to have compliance, and if we have to use a penalty, it would be to try to bring someone to the table. But first and foremost, we want to get the safety enforced, and the penalties are there if there's no other way we can get somebody to come to the table. And that's kind of summarizes my testimony. Do you have any questions?
So, Lori, if we were not to establish the higher fine levels, is there a risk of losing the federal delegation?
There is a risk. I think it's probably low, but there is a risk. There is a lot of scrutiny and attention on U.S. Department of Transportation and PHMSA right now in the state programs, not so much because of gas pipeline issues, but certainly because of other hazardous material pipeline issues and rail transportation right now. But there have been a number of hazardous liquids leaks in different states, different areas of the country, and so state programs are coming under a lot of focus, and why aren't the states being as rigorous as they should be? And so while I don't think it's there, things are a little crazy right now with PHMSA.
Does it affect the amount of money that you get to the grant to implement the program?
Yes. Yes, it can.
How so?
Well, because there is a total point scale when they come in to do the audit. And so if there's 50 points for what they're looking at when they're on site, this is 2 points. So 2 points out of 50. And then that applies against some other criteria against what are, this is a reimbursement grant. And so we go and we do the work and they come back and they look at it and they say, gee, did you do what you're supposed to do? We'll give you X amount of money. And so I think I estimated that the fiscal impact could be in the range of $6,000 to $15,000 a year. You know, maximum would be to lose our certification. If we lose our certification, they've got to come in and do the work. So it's all kind of, it's in no one's interest to lose the certification, but that could certainly be something that they would push. again, U.S. Department of Transportation and the Pipeline Hazardous Safety Materials Administration are under a lot of scrutiny right now for how these programs are being run.
So how frequently have fines been levied, and what's the range of amounts that have been levied?
To my knowledge, we have fined once, and that was part of a stipulated agreement. That was about 2.5 years ago. That fine was for $40,000, and that was an issue of not good record keeping on a training issue related to welds, and it was a sizable fee that the company had to a sizable amount of money the company had to invest in to go in and do a sampling of those welds to make sure they were good. If they weren't good, they would have had to have redone all the welds. So the company had to absorb a lot of O&M to go in and go in and look at all the work that those individuals had done, and then there was the fee on top of it, because at that time it was felt that this was not paying attention to records as well as should have been, and so that was not just to get the thing right, it was also, we need to get your attention. About, I believe in 2010, there was another stipulated agreement, but that one was just to get the work done, and there wasn't a penalty or fee associated with it. Again, the point is we want the work done. We want to get the work done. There are those who have said you should be levying fees or penalties much more. Our concern is that you start doing that, somebody just views it as their cost of doing business. They build it into their business model. The fine no longer means anything, and we don't want to be there. We want that fee, again, to be a last resort. We want the world to be safe, and
you are sort of at the point that if the if things are not being done well, there's the potential of a pretty big problem.
Oh, yes.
In Oakland and a few other places.
San Bruno is terrifying. You know, that is, it's not a good thing. And we get in that situation. When I look at the magnitude of these penalties, if we're at that point, the operator has done something really wrong, and we've done something wrong for having not found it yet. And so it's a, you know, we live here. We're residents. We don't want these things to happen. And again, this is a lot about perception and about compliance with our certification with the feds.
I used to say that when I was in your shop that nobody knows what you're doing, and if they do, you've really screwed up.
Exactly. Yes, sir.
Usually starts with a bang.
Yes,
Senator
sir.
Senator Girard.
The question I have, and it varies from agency to agency, who gets the money if you fine?
Chair Byer, Senator Girard, that money would eventually come to the PUC through the Treasury. Because we don't do it very often, I don't pay a lot of attention to it. PUC funds, other fund account, and the general funds.
I said so. General fund.
Okay. So it's.
It's better if it goes to the general fund, then you're not rewarded for the fine.
It said that, didn't it?
That's what it is. It goes to the general fund.
Yeah, I mean, it's again, one of the things that Chair Byer was alluding to earlier in the day was our public process. So if something like this came up, there would be a very formal open public hearing before. It's not like the commission would be in a position where you just write a ticket and say, here you go, you screwed up, and we're giving, you know, you have to pay this money. It would be where people come to the table. It's like, is this a reasonable thing? We have somebody like Cub there. We have other interested parties. We would have people from the community because we would want to know. We'd want to do the fact-finding. Was this something intentional? Was it an oversight? What was the, if we find a violation, what's the potential impact? Was it immediate danger to life or property? And so that's a very public process where the person that would be, you know, being potentially fined would be able to come and present their case. So there's a very nice public process around that. Again, it's not like we give you power and we're just going to write a ticket.
Go ahead.
The second question I have is, it seems like you might be in competition with these large fines. Say there was the big bang with civil suits going on and the ability to pay. $2 million is a fairly sizable fine, and the public may have been harmed. That $2 million doesn't go to help the, doesn't go to the victims, if you will. Do you see what I'm going to do?
Absolutely, and that's the importance of a public process. And what, again, the goal is to make sure that the facility operator is operating their facilities in the safest way possible. And these fines are, we're looking at violations of code. They're not always just when you have an explosion and you have a lot of damage. This is if we find something that would lead to, or we believe would lead to, a potential incident. So an explosion is the worst possible case of something that's going on. And I can only imagine that we would be in a very public discussion about what's the appropriate way to fine, what's the appropriate way to provide restitution to those who are harmed. Because, again, it's not our goal to fine. Our goal is safety. And so, I.
Kevin?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Kevin's here to answer technical
questions.
Just
answer questions. Oh, okay.
If you have them.
Anything else? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Mr. Bauer? You weren't on the list, but you were just sitting there.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. I guess I'll say we're neutral. Wouldn't want to say we want fines, but we do definitely support the commission and the staff. They have been helpful to us. Chair Beyer would know that the commission has supported our ability to actually remove all of our bare steel, cast iron pipe. We're in that process. It should be finished by the end of this year. For safety reasons, the staff is good to work with, but they're not pushovers by any means. And they are doing what their job is, which is to make sure that we are paying attention to safety. And in our business, safety is our number one issue and our number one goal. So we support their efforts as well. Thank you.
Any questions? Thanks, Gary. Anybody else wish to speak on this one? Okay, we will close the public hearing and we'll carry this one over as well. And let's see, now we have some last day for committee bill introductions, and did we have anything else before this?
Nope.
We're going to open a work session for the purpose of introducing legislative concepts into the process. Again, for the record, voting to support the introduction neither indicates support or opposition. It just gets it into the process. So with that, the chair moves that legislative concepts 2029-3715, 1310, and 3345 be introduced as committee bills. Discussion on the motion? Any opposition to the motion? The motion is approved. No, they're LCs.
Oh,
LCs. So, anything else for the good of the order? There is none, we're adjourned. There is none, we're adjourned.